Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, May 4th, 2017. A number of science topics tonight. I'll be talking about the moon Enceladus of Saturn. Now, I've had some pictures on my page. I'm not sure if you've noticed them. Just scroll down a little bit. You'll see them. You'll also see some experiments that I've done using a plastic type of material. I call it a milk boil, because milk does a very similar thing. It has polymers. Now, a polymer is simply a long chain hydrocarbon molecule similar to what we call oil. Oil, petroleum is a hydrocarbon chain, but milk also does this when it's heated. And so it forms some very interesting properties. And if you put some things in along with this, you get some very interesting conditions. So anyway, I'll be talking about that. Also, there's a phenomenon, it's been called Steve, and that's a mnemonic that people really haven't figured out what to call this yet, but it's a spiked visual phenomena that accompanies auroras. And I'll be talking about this because that's right up my alley in terms of science, and of course, it's something I predicted. There's a series of satellites that look at the Earth and take photographs and look at weather conditions, atmospheric conditions, and can see the upper atmospheric conditions. So what they're seeing is when this occurs, now what it is, visibly, you can see it from the ground, it's been observed, and that's where it was first really noticed by people who have been studying auroras, aurora borealis, the northern lights. And of course, this happens at the South Pole also. We see this on other planets. We see it on Jupiter and Saturn. We do not see this on Venus because Venus does not have a magnetic field. So these are characteristic signatures. When the proton streams come down into the atmosphere, that's basically what we're seeing. But we're also seeing electron streams. So anyway, I'll be talking in a little bit more detail on that. First of all, a couple quick notes. I mentioned this on John Moore's show yesterday, that there could be a time, and who knows, it might be sooner than later, and I hope this doesn't come to this, where we have only shortwave radio. And what's going on is, well, I'll just put it this way. I have many things that are interfered with in my life, and I'm not going to go into details, but it's been going on for years. This is nothing new to me. My whole life has been interfered with, and so I'm not going to, you know, go into detail. All of you, my listeners, the people that listen to me regularly, know all of these stories. I allude to them sometimes. I go into more detail sometimes, but the internet is really fragile these days. They're taking people off. I don't put anything on YouTube, but the people who use Facebook and YouTube as their method of distribution are going to be in a seriously hurting way if they decide to shut those down. They're already playing and tampering with people, shutting down their accounts, blocking their accounts, blocking people from getting to them. And in my own way, things are happening to me also. So anyway, all I'm saying is that shortwave might be someday and possibly soon the only method of listening to alternative media, because for thank goodness, the great people at, for example, WWCR, they have over the years, decades, held to the rail, so to speak, and maintained this ability of free speech. And that's not happening. That's not being allowed on the internet. And I've always said they won't shut down the internet. They'll simply control it, because it's a very useful tool if you control it. And if you look at things like Wikipedia or Google or Yahoo or Mail, Gmail or whatever, it was very predictable that once the capabilities of monitoring, storing data, analyzing to the level they can analyze today, that this level of control would all of a sudden begin. And they can spot you a mile away. If you get on a different computer, all of a sudden they know who you are, like almost instantly. and they start throwing ads up in front of you. Well, just the same way they can throw ads up on your computer, because last week you went to do, say you did a search for a, you know, anything, a cup of coffee online. I don't care what it is. All of a sudden you start getting cup of coffee advertisements popping up on your webpage, and you're like, I don't want to see this, you know, and then you can exit away, and then the next time you go on another webpage, there's the cup of coffee ad again. And so they know, you know, the point is that they can throw information in your face that they want you to see, or they want everybody to see, or you specifically. So anyway, there's on shortwave, that doesn't happen because you are you, and of course, I'm commercial free. I take care of all the business myself, and my way of dealing with this is that when you buy my products, that's the income that pays for the bills. So, but the short part of this is get yourself a shortwave radio. I'm telling you now. And somebody called in and asked what kind of shortwave radio. And I would recommend a small one. I personally carry, and I used to give away, I don't have access to those anymore, those little Kato dial band radio, shortwave, wonderful little radio. I still have some. And but the thing I carry now is a little bit bigger. It's about the size of maybe two packs of cigarettes. That's what we always compare things to. It weighs about a pound, maybe. It runs on three AA batteries, just to give you a feel for that. But it's digital. Get one with a good digital dial. And it also gives the time, and it's got AM and FM. And it's got all the bands, go down to about, my wintertime frequency is 5070, so 5.070 megahertz. Make sure you get with enough bands that go down that far. But a lot of the cheaper shortwave radios do not include that lower frequency band, and that's very important because WWCR goes down into those frequencies, and they have a lot of wonderful hosts that you may want to listen to. And there's a lot of international shortwave on that, those lower bands also. So make sure you get a shortwave radio that goes down into those bands. And a digital readout, because then it locks in on that frequency. And shortwave can vary. So if you got the old-fashioned band type of tuner, then it can wander off constantly back and forth, and it's kind of annoying. But with the digital, they lock in on that frequency, and they'll keep you right there. So what I have, I'll just tell you, it's a Kato 1101, I believe it is. Let me quick look here. Open this thing up. It's Kato, is K-A-I-T-O is the brand name. Yeah, 1101. And then a little wire antenna. It's just a wire cord. It's about 10 feet long. It's got an antenna plug on one end of it. You just stick that into the plug. And then I told people to get a set of these amplifying earphones. They're used for deadening the sound if you're on an airplane or something like that. And they're electrical. But also they have a plug-in, so you can plug into, say, a radio or a CD player or something like that. But the beauty of that is that it's got an amplifier in there, and you can hear stations with that you cannot hear with any other form of listening device for shortwave. So you can pick up stations that you don't even hear when you're tuned into it, with just the regular microphone or the little speaker on the radio. But you plug these headsets in with an amplifier, and you can pick up stations that you don't normally hear. So anyway, just a little advice there. Number two, the YouTube channels and the news, what you might consider news, daily news programs, or these hundreds of little news outlets, so-called news outlets that have popped up all over, with everybody seems to be an expert and they rebroadcast other people's postings and things like that. They're trying to be news centers. They don't have any staff to go out and see news stories or record news stories. They depend on what other people write. So they literally read from somebody else's site. And so it's very difficult to see if they're even true, but there's The point is that there is just completely fake news stories being posted, and I see CIA written all over this, like Bill Clinton is giving his deathbed confession, or that a certain movie star has been shot while hunting, or something, you know, that turns out to be a completely, completely false story. And so this is what I'm saying. And then they have some of these so-called truth monitoring networks that come in, like, say, Snopes is a good one, or Snoops, they call it. It's spelled Snopes. And, I mean, it's purely CIA-controlled garbage, this little dialogue. So anyway, it's really getting worse, a lot worse out there. And what they're doing is trying to throw a bunch of chatter out there to basically, confuse the public. Okay, enough of those initial announcements. A few listener emails. Here's something I thought was funny. A fungus in the space station. Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine being caught up there? Now, let me tell you something about microbial organisms, something I happen to do a bit of study on, quite a bit of study, in fact. And once these get loose, they're typically spore-related. In other words, their seeds, so to speak, are spores. And once these get on things, they're literally impossible to get rid of if you don't have a clean environment. And so when you study these things, they're typically done in a very controlled environment. But once they're loose, like in a laboratory or even worse, in the space station, where you've got gauges and handles and things all over the place, these things can get tucked in and hide, and they'll be there forever, literally. And so once a place is contaminated, now they say this fungus is in the water system, in the tubes. They've had to open up piping on the space station and remove this globs of fungus. And they're going to try and identify it in outer space. But the typical way of identifying this, they say, is to send it back to Earth, where they can put it in a laboratory. Now, NASA has not been very good. Let's put it like this. Over the years and decades, they've contaminated planets. They've contaminated the moon. They've contaminated outer space with space junk. But on the microbial level, they've entered the atmosphere of Mars, putting spacecraft there that have not been disinfected. So Earth bacteria, things like that, have now already infected other planets. These people, somebody's got to stuff a rag in their mouth, and basically, but here's the problem too. I just announced last week there was a woman who's been, 537 days or something in space and continuing. But once these people become contaminated, there might be a point at which they can't come back. And we can't send anything that comes back. In fact, I've had a policy of my own that should be initiated that you do not bring anything back to Earth. And if you bring people back or anything related, clothes, you know, unless they come back naked, but basically clothes or, you know, space helmets or anything, you have to be serious about decontaminating this, because space is full of viruses. And especially when we go through, say, the comet tail of Venus, I talk about this every year, the space station does too. So these guys are out walking around, and that's like relative to radiation, relative to biotoxins, they treat it like space is just a place out there where, you know, it's like going to the national park. You go there and you come back and, you know, it's like going on vacation. It's not the case. This is serious business, and NASA has proven over and over again that it does not know what it's doing. And to bring back this kind of fungus, they don't know what it is. You know, who knows what it is? I mean, this could literally be something that came from outer space, and they're going to bring it back. And here's the test tube. Here, I'll hand it to you. You remember that the spacecraft, what was it, the Deep impact spacecraft. I believe it was the deep. No, it was the Stardust spacecraft. That's right. It went through the tail of a comet and picked up material, brings it back to Earth, and then the landing craft looked like a little kind of flying saucer. It looked like little green men might pop out of it. But anyway, the parachute didn't open. It lands in the middle of the American Southwest desert, smashes into the ground, you know, and they go up and they take these samples. They take them back to the laboratory and analyze them, and they have DNA. They have nucleotides. They have potentially viruses in this material, and they just treat it like, here it is, like, you know, take a napkin of swab this stuff out of the corner of a restaurant, take it off to the lab. There are so, NASA, you know, a number of years ago, they hired a woman, I remember. She was supposed to be in charge of this aspect of NASA's exploration. And basically, she just sounded like a dodo, like, yeah, I'm going to sit in this office, sit in this chair, and that's what we do for, you know, making sure we don't contaminate space. Anyway, totally disgusting. They are trying to use a DNA sequencer, which would allow them to identify the mold or the fungus that's growing around the space station. Let me tell you, I wouldn't feel too comfortable if I were those people up there. Literally, if there was something there that really you can't bring back to Earth, I can imagine a condition in which those astronauts would be trapped there for literally the rest of their lives. Because, you know, or would they bring them back and say, oh, gee, we just can't do that to these people, and bring them back and contaminate the rest of the planet? NASA would do that. Here's another email from a listener on the possibility of changing laws in space and lunar exploration, because so many people now are starting to go out in outer space, private corporations, other nations. It used to be just so-called the United States. But the question is, who owns outer space and who owns the real estate? Well, it's the old rule. It's the first guy there to get there, and the first guy to get there who can maintain their stake. And so, like in the Old West, if you went out and farmed a homestead and you left it, well, if some guy walked onto it, that was his. You know, you didn't get to come back and take it back. So outer space is going to be like the Old West, and there could be a few shooting matches when it comes down to who owns what. In the United States, abandoned, if it did get to the moon with men, you know, planted a flag or whatever, which if you believe that, I don't know, whatever. But even if they did, they've left and left any stake there in ownership. So the United States has no stake in the moon or any place else. I've always said that if you want to be in outer space, forget taking the military. But because the military is only going to bog things down, cost a lot of expense. I talk about this in my book, The Diamond Principle. Just another quick mention. Somebody wrote in about man-made tsunamis, and there's a story, and who knows where these stories come from, if they're true or not. But they have an element of truth in that these are possibilities. Man-made tsunamis. Now, remember that the Japanese tsunami that allegedly caused Fukushima, the reactor, to blow up. Reactors don't blow up. They melt down. And Fukushima was a man-made explosion. I mean, it was definitely blown up. And the tsunami that came in that day after about a 5.0 earthquake, very low-level earthquake, the tsunami was not what caused the reactors at Fukushima to explode. Like I say, reactors don't explode like kaboom. You know, if you saw steam coming out, that'd be one thing, but that's not what happened. It literally was blown up with explosives. Okay, so, but the point is, could you cause harm or potentially blackmail the United States, or who knows, whatever, with the possibility of man-made tsunamis? And so the story talked about Russia setting nuclear bombs, sleeper bombs, off the coast of the United States that could be triggered at any point to cause a tsunami. And of course, minutes later, these big waves would be rolling into the West Coast and the East Coast, and who knows, the Gulf of Mexico, into the southern coastal states, you know, from Texas to Florida in the Gulf there. So who knows? I mean, this is definitely a possibility. There's some other more nefarious types of tsunamis that could be conceived of. I'm not going to go into details, but yeah, this is true. I mean, if we were going to cause a tsunami in Russia, Russia doesn't have that many coastlines, the real coastlines, and where they do, they're not population centers. The Russian population centers are inland. And so it's, you know, like they could do to us, which we could not do to them simply because of geography and where the population centers lie. So anyway, just a little bit of reporting. Yes, this is possible. And, you know, what do we do? Our biggest populations live along the eastern seaboard from Miami, Dade County, Fort Lauderdale, on up the coastline. I mean, it's just all highly populated up to D.C., New York, etc. And a big tsunami coming in there in a matter of short amount of time, no. There's no way to get the people out. It would just be adios amigo. And the West Coast the same. L.A., the L.A. Basin, San Francisco, the Oakland area, and depending on how big the tsunami was. And then, of course, Seattle and up the West Coast. You know, that's where you take that out, and there's not much left of the United States. You take out all the port facilities. So, you know, not a good situation. But at any rate, they asked me to make a comment on that. And it's out there. I mean, there's an important thing to notice, and to note that there was fake tsunamis. This is what I might add to this story, is that as with Japan, once you got the tsunami going and the related, say, earthquakes or anything that could go with that, you could do other things that you could then blame on the tsunami, like blowing up nuclear power plants, etc., which would cause further disaster and could be blamed on, oh, a natural event, an act of God, or whatever, like they did with Fukushima. So, no, it's not a good situation. In fact, there's a lot of people I know that would not be interested in living next to the coastline, not only for those potential, say, terrorist type of activities, but just because of natural tsunamis. Just a quick mention on my paid cast. We have May coming up, so the topics should be posted by the time this show airs for the May paid cast topics. Primarily, it's going to be an ongoing continuation of the Cosmos series, The Real Story. That's the where I use the talking points of Carl Sagan's Cosmos series and Neil deGrasse Tyson. And I may try to shorten these up because the way it is, if I do all of the different shows, there are 13 episodes of the Cosmos series. If I follow the sequence in the paid cast, including some Tesla's mind and some other topics intermixed, this will take us through to July. But remember why I am doing this. Now, I got some heated emails from listeners, and here's the situation. The paid cast, when I package this Cosmos series at the end, there's going to be more audiovisual included, etc. But this is to go on the offensive against some of the most offensive science on the planet, which is standard tier two fairy tale science. And so when I get all done, I'm going to do some more editing and then put this out there. But remember that this will be some people's only view of what I do. And unfortunately, or fortunately for some people, they are students and they've studied all my books and everything else. So this is kind of rehashing some detail for them. But remember that the vast majority of the wider population of the world doesn't sit down and study and read books, etc. And so what I'm trying to do here is to create a venue in which my material is digestible, palatable for the guy out there sitting on a bus going to work and flicking through things on his cell phone. 90% of internet traffic today and viewing happens on a cell phone. And so not many people are going to sit down and read a book or analyze it. And that's really a shame. It's really a shame. But on the other hand, remember that 600 million people on planet Earth, that's, you know, close to 1 billion people, I imagine by now, have seen the Carl Sagan Cosmos series, and they think he's the smartest man on the planet, when everything he says in that Cosmos series is wrong. I mean, he goes through step by step, pounding on these standard science points. Anyway, that's why I'm doing this. I want a presentation that in 10 or 20 or 50 years is a confrontation to what we call standard science. And for many people, this will be their only input into the James McCanney science world. And the other alternatives out there are really a lot less palatable. Anyway, I won't go into a lot of detail, but anyway, that's why I'm doing this. And so, but it's a good review. Also, what I'll be concentrating on in these future episodes, I'll be using the Cosmos series, Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Cosmos series as talking points, but I'll be concentrating on in going into depth on my scientific topics, and I guarantee you there'll be pieces here that nobody has heard before. And so going into detail and pointing out some of the fine points dealing with the term I created back in the 1970s that I used, and it was in my published papers called Electrical Universe, which, you know, there's two dozen copycats out there today. But the point is, that's my term, that's my work, and this is my statement for the general public. So for better or for worse. And it's real difficult because I have to talk to audiences that only listen a little bit, that only, you know, listen some. There's professional scientists that listen every week. There are professional scientists who publish papers on a regular basis based off on what they hear on my show. I can show you who they are. So anyway, it just is a crazy world out here, and you're swimming with the sharks. But, you know, life in a big city. But anyway, that's my paid cast, and so I recommend that people go sign up for this. It's $3.95 a month, and you get every week an extra episode. Okay, enough of that. Just a quick note on my water filters. They're still on sale, just as a little extra promotion for this weekend only on the what I call the Econo packages. That's the stainless steel kitchen standard, the full-size stainless steel water filter. It was on sale for $499. That comes with a 10-pack of filter elements. And $599 comes with a 10-pack of Imperial filter elements, so you can do the upgrade to Imperial. But I'm knocking another $30 off of these Econo packages for both the stainless steel and the plastic HDPE food-grade plastic water filters with the 10-pack. And so that's a really, really good deal. And so I encourage you to jump on that. Once again, just go to my homepage, jmccsci.com. Scroll down, hit one of the links that go to the sales page. And then when you scroll down there, look for the Econo packages, and you'll see that those have another $30 knocked off on those. A really good deal. So you get the filter plus two filter elements, plus a 10-pack, so that's a dozen filter elements altogether, set you long into the future for water filtration. Something, by the way, is really, 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 really necessary. If you're not filtering your water, if you're not taking bottled water with you from home to wherever you go, you're drinking water that's really bad out there. So you need to filter it. You need to filter it with something that works. Unfortunately, the majority of brands out there make a lot of claims, but they don't work. They simply don't work, or you have to buy add-on filters just to take out arsenic and fluoride. Mine take out everything, including arsenic and fluoride, all in one filter. Enough of that. But go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and remember that I don't sell flashlights, I don't sell food, I don't sell anything else. You can get that lots of other places. And your purchases help me, and the water filters really, really help you, believe me. And like I say, have your own water filtration system. Buy a aluminum, or if you can afford it, stainless steel water bottle for everybody in the family. Take your filtered water with you in your water bottle. If you go to sports, or kids going to soccer games or whatever, kids off at college, get them a water filter. Have a water filter. Very important. On to the main science topic. Now, there's a phenomenon called Steve, and this is just a nickname at this point. They really haven't found a name because this is such a new phenomenon. It's something that I could have told you existed a long time ago. In fact, I did, because what they're seeing here is basically the linear connection of the electron stream that's coming in. It's the hot electron stream that's coming in from the sun. And it happened the same situation with the solar wind. But here's the difference. The protons come in a broad band, and that's why when they follow the magnetic field lines down into the north and to the south pole that give you the aurora borealis, you can see it if you're at the south pole. It's just that there's a lot more land near the north pole where people live, literally, Alaska and the Arctic Circle. And so viewing the aurora borealis in the northern hemisphere is much more common, but it exists the same in the southern hemisphere. And it's different when the north pole is pointed towards the sun. The aurora borealis is different. And at that point, the south pole is pointed away from the sun. And remember, the Earth has a 23.5-degree tilt to the axis. And then vice versa, when the southern hemisphere is in summer, it's pointed towards the sun, so it gets a different current flow than the north pole, which is at nighttime at that point. And so basically, Steve, what people have noticed, and it was first noticed from the ground, is they're looking at the aurora, and all of a sudden there's like this sharp, a very narrow band of light that goes up into the sky. Sometimes it's like a pencil line, and sometimes it's broader, maybe a couple hundred kilometers wide. And it moves. It kind of moves around very rapidly. What they've discovered from satellite analysis with the Swarm satellites, these are run by the European Space Agency, is that the heating above the atmosphere, it heats up to like 3,000 degrees Celsius. Now, this is basically half the temperature of the surface of the sun. So we're talking severe heating of the very upper atmosphere when this phenomenon is occurring. And, of course, the streamers come down in. And protons, typically, this could be a proton stream. But typically, my belief is that it's going to be an electron stream. And they're not conscious of this yet because they don't understand that this is the electron beam that connects us to the sun. It's a very complex interaction. The typical northern... let's take a magnet. Just take a bar magnet that you would hold in your hand. It's a piece of iron. It's magnetized. And it's got a magnetic field. I'll put a posting of a magnetic field or the Earth with its magnetic field. But basically, if a charged particle comes flying in at high velocity from the solar wind or from outer space, from any direction, but typically they're coming from the sun, what happens when they hit that magnetic field, if the magnetic field line is perpendicular, in other words, they're hitting it broadside, then that makes the charged particles, the positive charges go one way, the negative charges go the other way, and they bend in the magnetic field. But if they can follow the magnetic field lines down, they actually basically follow them into the north and south pole of the Earth. And this is can be very dangerous for people living in high latitudes because these streamers of charged particles come in unabated. They're not slowed down. They don't stop. They come all the way down, and they typically stop in the upper atmosphere and create this beautiful auroral display. But Steve, this newly discovered phenomenon, is a very narrow, basically, tube of electrical current. And so what happens there is the electron beam that comes in the discharge of the solar capacitor, that's what it is. It's a term I developed in my early word, and this is a term from basic physics courses. It's called the pinch effect. And when it's a relativistic effect on electrons, and basically, or protons, any charged particle moving in a bundle, it pulls them together. It pulls them together, and basically into it. So the more current there is, the tighter the bundle. And so the end result is that the electron beam that is connecting us with the sun is very narrow. It's very, very narrow. And the same with comets. It's the plasma discharge comet model. You can see it in my work, in my papers, etc. But anyway, that's what's going on here. And equally, during the different times of year when either the North Pole is pointed towards the sun, it has a greater propensity to have the electron beam coming into the sunward side. So typically during the, say, April to November on the northern hemisphere, and the other months of the year for the southern hemisphere when it's summer in the southern hemisphere. So anyway, see how many people get to publish papers off of what they heard on my show here. But at any rate, that's, I'll be reporting more on that. That's something I'll be following. And but it's something that was very predictable. It's very interesting to see that this was only discovered, and that the European Space Agency and NASA for decades have been actually seeing this, or it's in the data. When you go back into the data, it's there, but not recognizing that it was there. And it took some amateurs to actually see it from the ground and point it out and say, hey, how come you guys aren't saying anything about this? This is pretty amazing, the beam that sticks up into the sky. And one interesting part of this is that the European Space Agency has already determined that it's not the proton. So they really don't know what's going on, because the proton, signature, they say, is typically not highly visible. And so that would rule out that this was due to protons. Anyway, so we'll continue to follow that and bring you updates as they occur. Okay, on to Enceladus, icy moon of Saturn. Now, if ever there was an object in the solar system that would, number one, disprove the major pillars of NASA standard astronomy theories and prove my work, it's Enceladus. Now, let's just take a look at the basic premises of standard science, that the solar system formed all at one time 4.5 billion years ago. Enceladus doesn't fit at all. Okay, that's, now these are what I call the axioms of astronomy, that there is no electrical phenomenon in the solar system or universe, and that comets are dirty snowballs, icy balls, or whatever. Well, let's look at Saturn in general. The Saturn rings are basically water ice, chunks of water ice, very small. And in their position in the solar system, the solar wind, now let me give you a little fun fact about solar wind. You would think that as it gets farther out away from the sun and diminishes in extent, etc., that it would become weaker. And the end result is that no, it doesn't. But there's another thing going on here, and that is that Saturn itself is discharging the solar capacitor. So there's a lot of current flow by the planets, a lot more than just in the average solar wind. So you're getting that concentrated solar wind. You're getting the concentration due to the fact that Saturn is there. And then also the moon Enceladus. And I, now if you look on my webpage, there's a map of the structure, the orbital positions of the moons around Saturn, of the rings, and there's a number of different views, so you can get a feel for what we're talking about here. But Enceladus sits out away from Saturn's magnetic field, and so therefore is literally exposed to the solar wind, and actually quite a bit more. Because one thing is the localized magnetic field of Saturn, but the other thing which Enceladus sets in is the proton wind, the fusion proton wind of Saturn. So there's two things here, one that NASA can see and measure, and one that it doesn't know anything about. So imagine that Saturn is like the sun, which it is. It's a small star. It's the unlit. It gives off three times the amount of heat as it receives from the sun, a great deal more than Jupiter. And nobody seems to know why, and that's kind of been swept under the rug. They just don't talk about that anymore. But the literal reason is because there is ongoing fusion in the atmosphere of Saturn. It has an atmosphere exactly identical composition-wise as the sun. Jupiter the same, although Jupiter is larger, older, much older than Saturn, just because of the activity level. But Enceladus is a moon that sits in the Saturnian proton wind. Okay, and even if you discounted that completely, it sets in the solar wind. The biggest comets in history were discovered past the orbit of Saturn, a little fun fact that NASA likes to forget about, because all of these moons, the what we call the Galileo moons, the Galilean moons, the four big moons of Jupiter, three of them are icy also, are covered in ice. And they should be just raging big comets. And of course, none of this ice should be there after 4.5 billion years, even if it's eroded away very slowly. But, okay, so Enceladus could not possibly be 4.5 billion years old. It's a almost solid ice. It's got apparently a small rocky core. But it's also belching out a tremendous amount of heat. Here's this little icy moon about 500 miles across. So take a trip from Chicago to what? Probably out close to maybe into New York State, to Pennsylvania. That's how big this is. It's not very big. And by all standards, it should have been rock solid, frozen all the way to the middle, and there is a lot of water there, and if it were left all by itself. But in a solar wind scenario, it should be completely gone after 4.5 billion years. And it certainly should not be belching out geysers, steam geysers, out of the surface. Now, the surface is another issue. Now, I've got pictures on my webpage. Go take a look at those. There's the surface of Enceladus, and then you'll see there's craters there, and they look to me like bubbles, bubble craters. In other words, the gas or the bubbles were forming under the ice level, and then broke through and formed a bubble. They burst and basically fall in on themselves. And that's what these look like. But be that as it may, they, of course, could be impact craters. But on an icy surface, I don't think we're going to get the same kind of impact craters as you see on the moon, which is a solid surface with a core base that's deep going down into the moon. And so the other thing, though, is in these craters, you see them starting, there are pictures on my webpage, and I've got text along with them. The craters are starting to fissure, and this kind of canal-type features. Now, I show how this happens. I call it a milk boil. And the reason I call it milk is because it's a polymer liquid, and what happens is that when the polymer surface meets the vacuum of outer space, it starts to create a vapor layer. And then that vapor layer starts to contract and change shape. It forms valleys and ridges and troughs, and you see the bubbles breaking. And so basically in a basically broth, in a witch's broth, or in a James McCanney broth, if you want to call it that, you can see the same type of formation. So that indicates to me that there's a polymer production manufacturing center down in the heart of Enceladus, which means that there's a core that's hot. Now, let's quick take a jump out to Pluto. A year ago, more or less, the New Horizons spacecraft arrived at Pluto. And I did a similar type of polymer milk boil and recreated through the use of composition. You might say it looks almost like, to the average person, maybe oatmeal cooking. You know how oatmeal, once you get done cooking, it kind of blurbs and blah, 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 see, like that, if you ever seen oatmeal like cooking when it gets to its very last state. And then it's a bit more liquid, but I did this and I created another polymer milk, what I call a milk boil, and I duplicated the surface of Pluto. But what it shows is that there is a tremendous amount of internal heat in Pluto. Now, there again, Pluto should be the coldest place in the solar system, being the farthest from the sun. When you're at Pluto, in fact, when you're at Enceladus, the moon of Saturn, you turn around and look at the sun. The sun looks about like at Enceladus, it would look like maybe a planet like Jupiter on a clear night. So like a bigger than average star, a big star, but still a star. When you're at Pluto, I mean, the sun looks like kind of like almost like another star. So you're not getting any contribution of heat from the sun. So where does Pluto get the heat energy to have an internal core that's hot and bubbling and oozing at the surface? And you can actually see this going on. Enceladus, you can see the vapor jets coming out. After 4.5 billion years, boys and girls, ain't going to happen. After 4.5 billion years in the solar wind, it isn't going to be there. It's going to be gone away if the Dirty Snowball Comet model is correct, which it's not. And that's the point. And we look at the moons of Jupiter that have tons of ice, and they're much closer to the sun than Saturn, and you don't see any trailing. Now, let's look at the comet Hale-Bopp. It was discovered far beyond Jupiter. Dozens of comets, thousands of comets have been discovered beyond Jupiter. The biggest comets in history have been discovered beyond Saturn. So if the Dirty Snowball Comet model, which they used to call the Ice Ball Comet model, if that's correct, then none of these moons should even exist. Certainly not in their current state. And certainly not with high internal heat sources. None of this should exist. So number one, these objects are not 4.5 billion years old. Where did they come from? Where did they come from? Did they just kind of come in from Never Never Land and just kind of became moons with all this ice? Where did this come from? Well, standard theory doesn't explain it. Where they came from is the standard process for solar system formation, what I call the capture, the comet capture system of solar system formation. And so these are new objects. We have the moon Io, the closest moon of Jupiter of the four Galilean moons, is a volcanic cauldron. And when that was first discovered, the people at NASA said, oh, well, we have to come up with a theory. So they hip-pocketed it. I was at Cornell when this happened. And I remember being in a room when somebody says, well, that's due to maybe tidal forces. Tidal forces are a differential gravitational force. And near Jupiter, you would have a force that's stronger on the side near Jupiter and not quite as strong on the far side away from Jupiter. And this would allegedly cause kind of a pulsation, and the theory would predict that the majority of the volcanic activity then, because this was supposedly heating up Io, that the majority of volcanic activity would be around the equator, when the vast majority of volcanic activity is near the poles, where there's literally no pulsing of with the gravitational field of Jupiter. So their hip pocket theory didn't make any sense, but it sticks because it's the best thing they've got. And of course, they control the press. They control the peer-reviewed journals. They get rubber stamped when they print in Science or Nature magazine. And life goes on. They get the paycheck. A lot of these guys are retired now, living in retirement land, golfing on the government dole. Life's good when you're a NASA scientist, but they are completely wrong about everything they're doing. So the end result is that the three basic axioms of astronomy have been disproven. That the solar system is 4.5 billion years old, nope. That the comets are dirty snowballs, nope. And that there's, let me go for this last one now, electrical activity. Now, where did the energy come from as Enceladus was a giant comet roving through the outer solar system? Where does the energy come from? Because really, the solar wind is out there. It's like I say, it's continually moving outwards. It does not lose energy. And by the way, just a caveat, the reason I say that is because this works like the internals of a Van de Graaff generator, where you take the charge up a belt, a rubber belt. It comes off on a set of pins. It looks like a comb. And then you simply have a wire that goes out to the outside of this round aluminum bell. And the charge keeps going out there in spite of the fact that there's charge building up and building up and building up. And one might think, well, there's so much charge that at some point it's going to be reverse. It's going to block any further charge from coming out there. It doesn't. The more charge you put there, the more charge wants to get out there. And that's these are basic fundamental principles, and that's what the solar wind is doing. The more you belch out and create this nebular capacitor that surrounds the sun, the way out beyond Pluto, that's the positive side of the capacitor, the more you send out solar wind, the more it wants to do this. And so when you have a big comet, for example, Hale-Bopp, for a period of 6 years discharging that solar capacitor, then you lose a lot of energy from the solar capacitor, and that's where we are now. It's slowly building back up. That's why we had a six-year hiatus with no sunspots, because of Hale-Bopp. So all of this makes sense if you understand the plasma discharge comet model, the fact that the sun controls the electricity in the major solar system, Jupiter and Saturn, which are small unlit stars. They radiate in the infrared. They're very bright in the infrared. When you take a picture of Jupiter or Saturn and some on my webpage, if you go to the pictures of the day subpage, I have many pictures, but of Jupiter within the infrared. I believe I have some of Saturn also. They also have the auroras at the north and the south pole. But the point is that the sun controls the electricity in the solar system, basically the capacitor. And so when Enceladus was in its comet stage, discharging the solar capacitor, tremendous amount of energy being expended, with especially the electron beam coming from the sun. And it doesn't matter how far out you are. Look at Pluto, way, way, way out there. And as the New Horizons spacecraft approached Pluto, one day NASA was snapping pictures, and of course I was grabbing them as fast as they hit the internet. They came up with a series of pictures, and they actually published it. And yet, when you put these into a little video, you see the moons of Pluto. There used to be one known moon. Now there, I believe, are four known moons of Pluto. But you could see those moons and Pluto all with comet tails. And I put a posting on my webpage, and bingo, those... I've learned a long time ago, when NASA's putting out pictures, you better grab them, because they're going to disappear real fast when they figure out what's going on. And of course, these pictures showed conclusively that Pluto and its moons were acting as comets. Well, there should be no dirty snowball comet model out at Pluto. Then they get there and they find out that the geology of Pluto is one of a warm internal heat source planet, and they stopped talking about all of that. All of that, just they said, well, we have to analyze the data. But already knew and I had predicted that Pluto would be, as are all of these Kuiper Belt objects, very warm because they're in the process of formation. When you look at the nebular ion clouds that surround other stars, which we have many pictures of, you see the comets forming way out there. You see hundreds of them. So that's where the Kuiper Belt objects come from, and they're going to be warm. They're going to have internal heat sources. Warm is a relative term. In terms of where Pluto is, it's quite cold, but we're talking about nitrogen liquid, not water liquid. There's some water liquid mixed in, but of course that would be frozen very solidly. The other thing you can see about Pluto is you can see the layers of the comet material from the tail nestling in on the surface of Pluto. I've got a picture of that on my subpage also. You can see it where they have the pictures of the milk boil. You can see the haze layers above Pluto. Pluto does not have an atmosphere. It's too cold to maintain an atmosphere, yet all of this material is falling in on it from the comet tail. Okay, so back again, what does Enceladus prove? What does Pluto prove? What do the moons of Jupiter prove? It proves that the solar system was formed by capture and that these objects were comets, because where did all the energy come from? Well, from the comet stage. Now it's in orbit around Saturn. And if you look, the other thing is that Enceladus is buried in a comet ring, a comet tail ring. And you can see this. Once again, I'll have pictures on the webpage, jmccsci.com. So Enceladus, Pluto, the four moons of Jupiter, disprove conclusively the standard basic three axioms of astronomy. The fourth axiom of astronomy, by the way, of standard astronomy, is that the universe began in a Big Bang. And of course, that is not true. Once again, my induced electric dipole redshift shows that the redshift for quasars, galaxies, etc., is not due to the idea that they are moving away from us, but because it is because of a non-uniform electric field caused by the fusion process around all of these objects, and that causes the redshift. So you have quasars that are associated with galaxies that have tremendously different redshifts. Standard astronomy cannot explain this, and it looks like I'm about out of time here. So just remember, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. Remember the extra $30 off the Econo Packs near the top of the page. That's the stainless steel and the plastic water filter. It comes with its set of two filters, either standard or imperial upgrade, and another 10-pack. And those were on sale, 10% sale, now another $30 off just through this weekend. So go and grab those. Remember to sign up for my paid cast, all of this on the webpage, and go make sure you see the pictures for this week's radio show of Enceladus and Pluto. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.